latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
A triple crown for the ages wraps up with the Belmont Stakes on Saturday, June 8th. And no matter who you're betting in the Belmont, your best bet is with ExpressBet. ExpressBet's world-famous Belmont Stakes wager guide is available Friday, May 31st. It features analysis, insights, and picks from handicappers like Millie Ball, Steve Bick, and Jeff Siegel. Plus, cash in on ExpressBet's promotions, including a money-back guarantee on the Belmont Stakes and a 10% exacta bonus on Gold Cup Friday. And if you don't have an ExpressBet account yet, now is the perfect time to get started. New customers who sign up before the Belmont get up to a $500 welcome bonus. Your best bet is with ExpressBet. Visit ExpressBet.com to learn more. And remember to join ExpressBet on Saturday, June 8th to watch and bet the Belmont Stakes.
Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void where prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. Racelens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Echobase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/racelens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse offers the year-round excitement of live thoroughbred racing and full card simulcasting from tracks across the country. Check out hcpn.com for the latest racing calendar, wagering information, daily entries, and results. All you need to enjoy your day at the races. June 1st will be the biggest day ever at Penn National, highlighted by the $500,000 Grade 2 Penn Mile. First post, 2:45 p.m.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
I want you to know it's time to go. Yeah, we are done.
We're back at the races and about 5 minutes to the top of the hour. Jeremy Plunk is going to join us and actually hearing the ad for Penn National coming up this weekend and the... They close today, right? Tuesday. So we'll have the Penn Mile and the Match Series races to peruse, and you get over to Grantsville, right? You go down to catch them there once in a while.
Yeah, the old stomping grounds. My dad was there the very first night that they opened the place. He played in the original World Series of Handicappings back in. The day there when I was a young kid, would wait for him to get home at about midnight after the night races to see how he did in that tournament. And, yeah, we still get down every once in a while to Grantville to play the races there. And, of course, you know, nothing like the Penn Mile. You know, back in the day, John Henry made an appearance at Penn National in the Chocolate Town Handicap. Right near Hershey, PA is where Grantville is located. And so, you know, the claim to fame before the Penn Mile at Penn National was John Henry once won there. And, you know, Jive of Coolit and some horses that were regionally really good were known to peruse through Penn National, but nothing like we see now with this big program coming up Saturday. Pretty cool for the small tracks to get on the big circuit, if you will. And I think they took the lead. You know, their sister track in Penn Gaming, Charlestown, had a lot of success with getting some notoriety and putting some money into one big signature day with the Charlestown Classic. And I think that served Penn National pretty well. And they were smart in the calendar, for sure, you know, to put that between the Preakness and the Belmont. And a lot of people can ship to Penn National from a lot of places. That's one of the great things about growing up in central and now northeastern Pennsylvania is you can get to so many racetracks, you know, in a short distance. I can drive in, you know, within 4 hours, probably be at 15 different racetracks. And that's a pretty neat geographic area that a lot of people in the country don't necessarily have. You know, if you're from Arizona or California, you know, you might have one, two tracks within driving distance, some places not even any within a quick drive. So we're blessed here, and that helps that program for sure, Steve, because you can get shippers from a lot of places come in and that normally wouldn't come to Penn on a regular Friday, Saturday night.
Well, and the, you know, the addition of the, you know, of the match series and the way in which the program was tweaked to have these, you know, sort of, you know, individual location festival stops as opposed to the way they were doing it. They did it, you know, from the comeback edition last year where, you know, they were running at various racetracks, you know, based on each division by running, you know, the group of races, you know, on the same card. It really has had a lot of appeal. You know, they had the first one and it came off well, and it just fit in beautifully with, you know, with this card. So it'll have the attention pretty much of everybody, I think, on Saturday.
Yeah, and you get the horsemen too, right? I mean, cause the jocks can make it in for this. And, you know, they go with the 245 post, which is really a twilight and kind of an odd post for Penn National. You know, typically all night racing, starting midday and into the evening. But the one thing about Penn National, and people always wondered about this when they were doing like their 5-6 o'clock post, why they would put the key races early in the card. It's the position of the lights. The turf course isn't lit. So all turf racing at Penn National has to be done under the sunlight. So before dusk. So if you ever play a Penn National card on a regular Friday or Saturday night, you notice their turf races are always one or two on the card. First two, first three maybe are on the grass. That's why. And, you know, but it's going to be, you know, great to have the top jocks and some of the main barns will be there represented, obviously. You know, maybe the trainers send their assistants to Penn National. But if you want to get out and you're in the area and you want to see some of the stars, you're definitely going to get to see some top pilots there at Penn National. That's always fun, you know. The small tracks are that way. You know, I remember being a kid going to Penn and Charlestown and places like that. And my sister and I, we'd line up, like, along the edge of the paddock and try to get jock goggles after races as they're heading back to the jocks room and things like that. Yeah, you can get around in these small areas. You get a lot of access. And a small track like Penn National, you're right up on top of things, the apron, the paddock. It's all right there. It's all accessible. It's not cordoned off. And on a big day like this, you know, maybe you get a Javier Castellano or somebody like that to fling his goggles after the race. So pretty cool place to take your kids and go check it out. You know, casino at Penn National now. It's kind of changed the vibe a little bit. But on the racing side, most of the action's out on the apron and the picnic tables, and it'll be a fun atmosphere there on Saturday, I promise you that, if we get good weather. Rainy and ugly here in Pennsylvania today, but hopefully by Saturday we'll get some good weather because certainly want to keep those races on the grass.
And I think, I thought I saw, because I was looking for a different reason, but I think by the end of the week it should be nice. And, of course, the mile concept, that was a Dan Silver idea that you know, Dan, when in that, it was about a 2-year period that he spent there before coming back to the East Coast anyway. Penn and Grantsville is in the East, but it's west of East, and
yeah, you know, need 4 hours to get to the shore from there. But, yeah,
Where are the Alleghenies? At that, you're west of the Alleghenies, right?
You're further west. You're east of the Alleghenies.
East of the Alleghenies.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah. No, you got to further out to Pittsburgh. The one thing they always say politically about Pennsylvania, you got Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and 400 miles of Alabama in between. It's got, you know, there's a lot of rural in Pennsylvania around the two big cities, but. You know, that area where Penn National is in Hershey is really kind of a growing area. It's a suburb of Harrisburg, and a lot of housing and a good place to live. And you get a lot of Baltimore people, actually, in that area that commute down Interstate 83. Prices, housing prices, and, you know, in Maryland and some of the suburbs there, more expensive. And so it's a growing area. And, you know, they're doing well with the racing program at Penn National. You know, I mean, casino wagering hasn't been, you know, or casino gambling hasn't been the game changer for some of these racetracks, but it has kept them in existence. You know, without that, I mean, you see the way the leaky roof circuit, as they used to call it, Penn, Charlestown. Again, these tracks are near and dear to me. I mean, this is where I grew up going. There were 2,500 claimers with Harry F. Thompson and you know, Bobby Colton and you know, the stars of the 70s and 80s. At Penn National. Those tracks, Penn and Charlestown, were really, really hurting before casino wagering came along, and that gave them a second life. You know, it hasn't turned them into Saratoga, you know, for sure, but they have definitely existed because of the help of, no question about it, because of the casino gaming. You know, Penn National is one of those tracks that, again, you could just, that you can get there from a lot of places, and location helps a little bit, but you need some kind of purse structure and good racing to draw the folks in to compete. You know, back in the day, a Maryland horse would never come north. I mean, it's, you know, it's 90 minutes from Harrisburg to Baltimore, you know, to make that trip up to Penn National. It's not very far, but they just didn't do it back in the day. You know, I mean, Maryland racing was on such a different level than what Penn National was, running 2,500 claimers for a $2,000 purse. But the times have changed with the purse structure. They get more shippers now. You get some horses from Delaware, from New Jersey, and you know, if the condition book at Monmouth looks a particular way and you've got a better race, you'll see some Monmouth horses come over to Penn and pick off the spot. So it's definitely helped the racing program there. You know, again, you know, in Pennsylvania racing, it all really goes back to 2004, and Ed Rendell, the governor at the time, was infatuated with Smarty Jones, a big sports fan, you know, supporter of the Eagles and all the sports teams, and the racetracks really got a big boost from Smarty Jones and the bump that he gave this state and the political clout that he gave this state to bring the casinos to the racetracks. And places like, you know, Presque Isle wouldn't exist without Smarty Jones. Places like Parks, Penn National, they'd be hurting. They'd be absolutely hurting. And he really changed this state's racing culture 15 years ago, and we're still reaping the benefits of it. And races like the Penn Mile just could not have existed without Smarty Jones, would not be here.
Yeah, well, and you invoke Ed Rendell, that as an Eagle fan, that's a great tie-in, because he's a wild-eyed Eagle fan and sports fan in general, and it hadn't occurred to me that, you know, there was a coordinated element to his, you know, to his period in Harrisburg that would tie in, but it makes perfect sense.
I mean, he put Philadelphia Sports, you know, during that 5-week run, you know, everybody, all the national media converging, and it had a tremendous political clout. There's no question about it. I mean, at the time there was debates on what to do with casino gaming and would they go to racetracks and all that sort of thing like that, and that made racing in Pennsylvania relevant, and people saw how it could be important. And, you know, that was the push. That's what got it over the hump without question. You know, Park has obviously increased its profile over the years. You know, the Pennsylvania Derby now is a million-dollar race.
Grade one.
And has, you know, yeah, and has grade one. I mean, again, without Smarty Jones, Pennsylvania Derby exists, but it exists back in the days of, you know, a nice 250, 300 kind of race on the same level as the Leonard Richards at Delaware Park, you know, those kind of three-year-old races. Now it's a high profiler that determines some championships and brings really great horses to. So, I mean, if you talk about, like, how one horse impacted one state, I'm not sure, you know, it may be predating my history and things like that, and I'd love for someone to chime in on Twitter or a caller to your show sometime. Talk about how one horse changed an entire state. I can't think of anyone that would have had more impact than Smarty Jones on the state of Pennsylvania. It really
makes sense.
It is really remarkable.
Yeah, I'm just hearing from Todd Mostaller that in fact, they'll close tomorrow, and so we'll have the card. You know, they'll have the card tomorrow afternoon, and we'll talk to Todd actually this week. In advance of Saturday's action, and you know, beyond that, Jeremy, we're getting ready. It just occurs to me, not only will the entries close tomorrow for Penn, but the entry is going to close for the Belmont wagering guide tomorrow. So I've got to figure this out between now and tomorrow.
Yeah, the Express Bet Belmont Wager Guide will be available on Friday. People can download it free, no matter what state you're in, whether you're an account holder or not. You can go to expressbet.com beginning Friday and download that free wager guide. We put it out a week before all the Triple Crown races. Helps with promotion, gets people excited, thinking about their handicapping angles. And then, of course, with the handicappers who are part of you know, putting together the product, such as yourself, Millie Ball, Zoe Cadman will give workout analysis, Jeff Siegel, John White, Dick Girardi, Johnny D puts in his analysis. You know, for those folks, we give them a chance to update their analysis after the draw the following week so we can get the most updated picks. And Eddie Olczyk always comes in with a late update, too, to the guide on race week. So a lot to look forward to this Friday. And then, again, throughout the week, we'll update the analysis. But a lot of stats and trends and cool angles to take a look at towards the Belmont Stakes, and you get an early look at what folks are thinking. And, you know, this is a different kind of Belmont, obviously. No Triple Crown on the line, no Derby winner, but we have the Preakness winner. We don't get a whole lot of, like, Preakness/Belmont horses, you know? I mean, that's just not a historical thing that we've seen a lot of. A Fleet Alex pulled it off, and then, of course, Baffert's Triple Crown winners, point given. But there's not a lot of them over the years, so, you know, War of Will could put himself in some pretty heady category. When you talk about the horses in this decade, you know, since the 2000s began, you know, if you can be on a list with Point Given, a Fleet Alex, Justifying, American Pharoah, that would put War of Will in a pretty cool category. And, you know, he's obviously the headliner towards the Belmont. I get the sneaky suspicion, though, that Tacitus is going to be the horse that everybody turns to. He just has that profile, right, Steve? Run in the Derby and run pretty well. Lay off, take the 5 weeks, you come back, and, you know, I mean, Bill Mott was talking Belmont with this horse before the numbers even started blinking on the tote board at the Belmont, or at the Derby. You know, this was kind of his race kind of etched out, and it makes a lot of sense. So, Tacitus, War of Will, we're going to have, I think, dueling favorites on the tote board. I don't think either one of them is going to get too much separation from the other. I think they're both going to get best.
And I brought this up with John White yesterday, and John also leaned. He said he thought the Tacitus would end up, you know, and the money would gravitate in that direction.
Yeah, it, you know, it's Mott in New York. It's just, you know, a good Derby. Look, if you just want to go head-to-head, you know, this horse beat War of Will by a length or so in the Derby. Didn't have the same sort of trouble, obviously, that War of Will had. But I just get the feeling that Tacitus is the talk, the heat, the steam horse, and not just on a phony resume. Yeah, I mean, he's got a good-looking resume. He won three in a row before the Derby and ran as well in the Kentucky Derby as any Wood Memorial alum has in the last 15 years. You know, I mean, he ran a good race in the Kentucky Derby. He makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's kind of a home game, right? I mean, he's been pacing all winter, but, you know, he's back over a home track that he spent his two-year-old year at, familiar surroundings, you know. He seems like he'll be the one that on the tote board, you know, it depends on field size and things like that. Right now we're looking at, what, 8, maybe 9, maybe somebody else comes in and we end up with a 10th. I can't imagine we end up with an 8-horse field for the Belmont in a year where there's no just, you know, steamroll blowout kind of horse. So, you know, we'll probably get another one or two in there, which will affect the points and how we end up on the tote board. But you could see those two horses at, like, 2-1, 2-1, you know, kind of like somewhere both in that range. And then there's going to be some, you know, gaps to other horses. One thing interesting, though, I went back and looked at the charts of the Belmont over the last several years. Like the Kentucky Derby and like we saw at the Preakness, people just don't openly dismiss horses in the Belmont. There was only like one year out of the last six that there was even a horse 40-1 or more on the tote board at the Belmont. Horses kind of get covered. I think people look at it as, well, it's a mile and a half, anybody could win, that sort of thing. And in a year after we saw a 65-1 shot win the Kentucky Derby on DQ, you know, the Preakness comes back and horses that we thought would be 75-80-1 or 25-30-1 in the Preakness, I think there'll be a little bit of that defensive Dukes up betting from the public as well. So, you know, maybe you don't get those big horses huge at the end of the wagering, so that could keep the favorites in a little more playable category, you know. If there's a little money going towards those horses who should be 60-1 that are 20-22-1, then, you know, maybe you could hold it 2-1 around that on a favorite here in the Belmont.
You know, and you mentioned horses that are trying for dual classic winners, the second legs, and you mentioned Point Given and Fleet Alex. You go further back and you've got, you know, a horse like Little Current, you know, who got beat in the biggest
Risen
field.
Risen Star got the double.
Risen,
you know,
Star, that's a good
one. And he did it emphatically. You know, Risen Star might be a lot like War of Will if you want to kind of look at, you know, like where they ran in the Derby. Then they won the Preakness, and, you know, then he was sitting on, you know, his career race in the Belmont. You know, if he's a risen star, then he's going to be impossible to knock off, you know. But, yeah, there's not a lot of them. And when you talk like, well, risen star doesn't seem that long ago. It's like 1988. I mean, we're, you know, 31 years now. You know, that's a long time going back for some of these kind of horses. You don't get a lot, you know. There's 3 weeks between the Preakness and the Belmont. They're different kind of races, different kind of setups. Obviously, the distance is the biggest difference, you know, from a mile and 3/16 to a mile and a half, different kind of racetrack. Anytime I look at a stat or a trend or a number, I always try to think why, you know, and why is this number good? Why is this number bad? You know, you try to figure out, well, why do horses not run well from the Preakness to the Belmont? There's not that many that run like in all three legs. So you could say, well, it's the natural attrition of the three races in 5 weeks. But that's not many horses that we're talking about. The ones who jump in the Preakness, maybe the ones who jump in the Preakness were kind of second tier anyway. They didn't make the Derby or they had problems. So those are the kind that aren't going to just move right, you know, blow forward and run a huge race in the Belmont. Like a horse like an Owendale, right? You know, he wasn't ready for the Derby. He just kind of got on the Triple Crown sniff with the Lexington up against the Derby. Then he ran well in the Preakness. You know, like a horse like that historically, not him specifically, but a horse like him historically, maybe not ready for prime time at a mile and a half yet. I don't know. I'm always trying to figure out why on some of these things. But it has been the case. There hasn't been a lot of success tying Baltimore to Belmont.
Well, and a couple of – let's actually take a minute and touch on a few, you know, particularly the horses that we, you know, are going to be seeing their first, you know, their first Triple Crown event tries, and that includes Sir Winston, you know, the other Cassie, and a horse that's been, you know, that he's really – highly regarded within the barn. Mark was very confident, you know, again, even when he wasn't getting much from Sir Winston, you're also going to get Intrepid Heart. And, you know, I think there's going to be people that are dismissive of Intrepid Heart because the Peter Pan, you know, he went off at what, 6-5, and you know, and really didn't run an A race, and you know, a race that gives you confidence going into this. However, the end goal was always the Belmont with him,
right?
And
that race was run a lot different, 46-110. You know, fractions. I mean, that's a mile and an eighth around one turn, and the winner, Global Campaign, is a fleet, elite kind of fast horse, right? I mean, not a Belmont kind of horse necessarily, a Global Campaign. So completely different run race, I think, to Peter Pan. So like you say, I wouldn't be dismissive of Intrepid Heart because of the Peter Pan.
Well, and this is a horse that really fits this Todd Pletcher profile. And in the wagering guide, I regularly remind people, you know, particularly the people that love to belittle Pletcher because of his record in the Derby. The record in the Belmont is I frequently use the word enviable. I mean, for whatever reason, and I understand why his record looks the way it looks in the Derby. And, you know, I've said for years that the horses, particularly in the early days of his career, he was getting horses to the Derby that had no business getting to the Derby and being involved. He was getting middle distance horses, you know, to basically using the, you know, the earnings, but horses like a More Than Ready, for instance, More Than Ready wasn't a Derby winner, but Pletcher got him there, and it helped contribute to, you know, to a lot of careers. You go through that list of the horses that Todd had, you know, the first 10 plus years, they had no business being in that race, and he got them there, though. And
another thing, too, with Todd is he's a 5-6 week guy, right, on the regular circuit.
Yeah.
He's not a guy back 2-4 weeks. And for much of that, like 0-40 or whatever he started out, was when all the preps were 3-4 weeks out. Once the calendar expanded, got a little bit further, you know, I mean, yes, he won on 3 weeks with Super Saver, but Super Saver's kind of the outlier in his entire Triple Crown career, the one that doesn't kind of fit with the rest. But you look like an Always Dreaming, like the Florida Derby was 5 weeks away from the Kentucky Derby at that point. And that's more his pattern of training. And why you say, well, why does Todd do better in the Belmont than the Derby? Well, there's 5 weeks between those races. He never runs a horse in Baltimore at the Preakness unless he's almost forced to. So, again, it's spacing fit his program a lot more to be successful in the Belmont. Now that you get a lot more 5 and 6 week out from the Derby prep races that are final prep destinations, Todd's record has gotten better. He's had more horses, you know, run decently in the Derby and hitting the board and, of course, winning it with Always Dreaming. So, you know, like you said, we're always looking for whys and steps, you know. The Triple Crown Trail has changed in the way the races are spaced out, and Todd's record has gotten better as they've spaced out. I don't think the two are coincidence.
Well, and the pedigree, when you know we already have documented the Tappet, you know, Tappet's unusual success with the Belmont, but Flaming Heart happens to be by Touch Gold, and I mean, if there's a horse in here that's got, you know, Belmont breeding, quote unquote, it's Intrepid Heart. He fits from that standpoint.
Yeah, and the other is Sir Winston, the one you mentioned. You know, he's probably awesome again. He's definitely a mile and a quarter type, and out of an Affleet Alex mare. You know, Affleet Alex ran the race of his career in the Belmont Stakes. You know, I mean, he's remembered for, you know, the phenomenal get up and go in the at the top of the stretch of the Preakness Stakes. But you know, the Belmont was the race where Affleet Alex, where I think that he ran the best race of his career. Hey, just one a quick note, because I stumbled on this researching an article the other day, and just because I mentioned the Affleet Alex Preakness Stakes, but, you know, I stumbled in an article last night from the L.A. Times that Bill Christine had written after the 2005
Preakness. I saw you sent this. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, for the ride on Scrappy T, if you remember the top of the stretch of the Preakness in 2005. Scrappy T comes off the turn. Ramon Dominguez goes hard left-handed at an odd time to go left-handed, and the horse veered out, obviously, into Affleet Alex. And we all remember Affleet Alex being picked up and going on the victory. Obviously, there'd be no DQ in that situation because he outfinished Scrappy T. But in today's world, we look at that and say, well, obviously, the jockey got dazed. I mean, that was, you know, a dangerous situation. He went left-handed. The horse responds. Bill Christine's article from the L.A. Times from 2005 talks to the stewards who ruled that there'd be no days for Ramon Dominguez. He was exonerated for the ride. In fact, from the stewards, the quote was, you know, a former jock, I'm trying to think who it was it Hartack Passmore, one of the former jocks who was a steward in Maryland at the time?
Well, Passmore was in the stand. Passmore famously, very well could have been Bill Passmore.
Yeah, and because, you know, you hit a horse left-handed, you're going to get that. We've all seen that as a rider, so we don't hold him at fault for that. I mean, I can't imagine that, like, if you look at Luis Saez's case that he's making, he didn't use the left-hand stick. He didn't, you know, overtly guide the horse out into another path that we can tell, you know, other than, let's say, you can get in the mind. I don't know anybody who's looked at the reins and the hands and anything and said that they can obviously prove that he tried to go out into the path. So if Ramon Dominguez got 0 days for what happened, Triple Crown race, could have been disaster, head of the stretch. I mean, this was like even more in the camera focus than anything like, you know, the 516th pole of the Derby. I mean, it was like one of the most famous images we've all seen in the history of the Triple Crown on national TV, and he got 0 days for it. I don't know if I'm representing Luis Saez how I can take 15 days for my guy. You know, 15. I mean, that's... I would have to go back and say, look, I mean, we've been here before. We look at everything in today's society and say, wow, we've never seen anything like that before. We saw it in the 2005 Preakness. I mean, it's the exact same situation at a different time, and where the jockey obviously makes a move that would make the horse go out, and the jock got 0 days. I mean, look, Ramon Revere, you know, one of the most beloved riders of his generation, and you know, advocating now for the safer whips and everything like that, and good on him. You know, I mean, I'm all for that. But if Ramon got 0 days, there's a little precedent there. And anytime you're talking about legal cases, you know, we had this big, long argument, not argument, but the night before the Preakness, we have a big dinner with the Express Bet team, and we're talking to some of the management guys and things like that, and they're asking, well, what do you think about, you know, this legal case that's going on? I think there's, in the legal world, there's probably a couple areas where you can go to precedent and things like that that we don't get on daily rulings. You know, they don't necessarily look at precedent on a daily ruling, but I found it very interesting that Ramon, you know, and I hadn't thought about it. I didn't think about it back then because we weren't kind of trained to, like, being like, okay, well, how's this guy going to get punished for this ride? I mean, we were all in awe of what a Fleet Alex did. So we weren't even thinking about it back then. So the first time in my life, 14 years later after Fleet Alex, that I realized the jock got no days for that ride was last night when I stumbled into the article. I find it fascinating, and I can't imagine that Luis Saez and his representatives can look at one incident and their incident and say, we went 0 to 15 in these last 15 years.
Well, and it's funny that when you started down this road, I was going to say, oh, I just read an article. I just saw, and I didn't connect the dots that it was you that had sent out the link. But, yeah, not only did Ramon pop him at an odd place, he also hit him, you know, under the undercarriage. And you know, anybody that watched Ramon ride knows, I mean, that windmill arm of his, you got cracked by Ramon. You got cracked, but good. I mean, he was forceful with the, you know, with the whip. There's no two ways. I mean, I you know, it's not an indictment of any kind. It's just, you know, just the reality. I've told the story before. You know, we were doing the barbecue, and you know, by that point of the day, it's gotten quiet, and I went right to the fence by where the bleachers were, and I could go right up to it, and I was standing right there. It's the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen. It continues to be. Every time you watch it, you just cannot believe that Jeremy Rose, you know, doesn't go over his head. I mean, how he
that was one of the most phenomenal on-track performances. You know, you go back to Ali Sheva and you know, Chris McCarron, you know, getting clipped by Bet twice at the top of the stretch, and the angle and the severity of that doesn't even compare even close to a Fleet Alex and how close they were to going down. And then just to pick up and go, you know. And yep. Then not only just blow that field away over the last 400 yards of the race, and come back at Belmont and do it again, you know. That was
3 weeks later.
That was something, you know. I mean, Fleet Alex was really something. And, you know, we forget, too, he was a winner early two-year-old at Saratoga, you know. And still, you know, God, we rarely get those kind of horses that are fast early developers and then turn out to be classic type horses and then be classic champion type horses. You know, I mean, a Fleet Alex is really one of the real underrated horses, and maybe coming along the year after Smarty Jones, maybe he didn't get quite the credit he deserved. And I guess there's a cachet too with winning the Kentucky Derby that carries a little more historical weight with people, you know, whether it should or shouldn't. I think it should, but you know, like, it had a Fleet Alex been the Derby winner, maybe we'd talk about him in a little bit different terms, too. But what a truly great racehorse he was.
Well, the argument, there's plenty of people that argue that had Jeremy not, you know, not gone to the inside the way he did, that Alex could have won Derby, and you know, you take it from there. I mean,
he moved a little early. You know, that was one of those things that people thought he might have moved a little bit too soon.
Inside was supposed to. Everybody said that the inside was not the place to be. That particular day, that he kind of bogs down when he.
My guess, too, without
there.
Looking at that card, but I'm guessing he didn't have a mount on the undercard. I can't imagine that Jeremy Rose at that point in his career had much going, you know. So maybe he didn't have the advantage of being over the track as many times as some of the other guys. Or if he did have a mount, you know, what kind of horse he was on and where they were in a race. But, you know, he's not the kind of guy that, like, at that point, by the time the Derby comes up in race 12, has already ridden five races on the main track, you know.
Sure.
And that's. You know, that's part of it, too, when you come to this, boy, I can't believe you. Why would you not stay with a Julian Pimentel, a guy who knows the horse or something like that? You know, well, is there something to be known for having Julian Leperoux over Julian Pimentel at Churchill? Because he will be riding the entire undercard, will know the track better, you know? There's great decisions and great elements that go into those decisions, you know, that aren't just about, you know, experience matters, you know. Stuart Elliott, you know, riding the Belmont course. You know, a lot of people said that was going to be a disadvantage. Yeah. I'm not saying it turned out to be, but that was a concern of people going into it. You know, how would Stuart handle riding Belmont a mile and a half, which he's, you know, not accustomed to doing. And certainly, I mean, look, no jockeys are accustomed to riding two-turn races at Belmont. They just, you know, unless you're Johnny V or Javier Castellano, who've been around forever, and then they still probably have like 20 mounts maybe going two turns at Belmont. There aren't a lot of races, period, you know, other than the Brooklyn and the Belmont and an occasional allowance race maybe. But there's not a lot going two turns at Belmont for you, for sure.
Well, you got the new Gold Cup as well, and there's speaking of which, a couple of other notes here on participants. In addition to Intrepid Heart coming out of the Peter Pan, we're waiting for a decision. Who else? We're waiting for a decision on Owendale. I asked Brad Cox yesterday. He says no decision's been made, but there's a lot of people insisting apparently that he's not going to run. So we'll wait on that. We mentioned Sir Winston. The horses that are coming back from the Derby beyond Tacitus, of course, you got Spinoff, who seems to have some buzz. Tax appears to be, you know, set, and he's certainly, you know, as an arch out of a Giant's Causeway mare, has some sense. It's the Japanese horse that is going to end up having to be a referendum horse. And, you know, he ran a sneaky good race in the Derby, you know, when he had every right not to. And, you know, and speaking of riders, by the way, Leperoux with a huge few days. Eight wins? Eight wins over 2 days?
Yeah, he's like Mr. Churchill right now. He's lighting it up.
Yeah, so, you know, Master Fencer, it's been quiet at Keeneland in terms of, you know, his preparations. I know that he breezed, but, you know, there hasn't been much of many smoke signals coming out of Keeneland regarding the Master Fencer. So I'm looking forward to seeing him next week.
I'm interested in him a little, too. You know,
yeah.
I mean, look,
I think you have to be.
I was completely dismissive going into the Derby because, you know, let's be honest, I don't evaluate Japanese form. There was nothing for me to go with there. Didn't see enough of him trained before to get a good feel for, you know, how he fits. So in a 19-20 horse field, you go, I got to draw some X's on somebody, and I'm going to start right here because, you know, what I don't know might hurt me, but, you know, what I do know can hurt me for sure. So now you've seen that race, I think he's a legitimate contender in here. And you look at, you know, the mile and a half for American horses is obviously a gimmick distance compared to what they're used to running. There's a couple pedigrees in here that will fit with it. There's some horses that absolutely will not handle it. We know that going in. I think he'll run all day based on the international form, and will that be fast enough? You know, Lonnie ran a good third in the Belmont Stakes, and you know, I thought coming in that Lonnie had a little more credentials based on the races that he had run in. But this horse ran as well as Lonnie did in the Derby, if not better. And Lonnie handled the mile and a half well and ran with the, you know, went through the entire series. I think Master Fencer's a horse you've got to consider in here. And, you know, I mean, look, we know War of Will, we know Tacitus. And beyond that, you start to get into the, you know, I got to think about this one. Can I make an excuse for a race? Can I push forward with them trying to get beyond the couple horses that are going to be around 2-1 in here? And Master Fencer, I think, would be a playable horse. You know, price dependent, obviously. We don't know if we're going to have 8, 9, 10 in the field. But if you got somewhere, I hate to repeat 8, 9, 10, but if you got somewhere around 8, 9, 10-1 on him in the Belmont, I don't think that would be terrible. You know, I think he could be playable somewhere around 10-1.
Well, this is, I'm glad we're doing this because I really haven't given this any thought, and I'm going to have to write up my thing for tomorrow. And you know,
so you're coming over for study hall tonight,
I guess.
Is that what we're saying?
Well, between War of Will and Tacitus, who I've got no problem, you know, including prominently. But beyond that, you know, one of the regular themes of this race is that you never want. You know, you never want a deep closer type, and everybody's expectation is, oh, a horse that was closing successfully in the Derby. And this is one of the Master Fencer issues, that if you're you know, if you're a deep closer, oh, the mile and a half is going to suit them. That's not the way
right.
it works. You want a horse that is just going to, you know, click along and at steady, you know, at a steady beat. And
do we know that he's like a 20-length closer, though? That's the thing, you know? I mean,
yeah.
he was in the Derby, but he was in that terrible post right on the edge of the auxiliary gate, got knocked around. And then it's a sloppy track, so you know as well as I do, if you're going to run towards the back of the pack with a sloppy track, you suck all the way out of it. So you're not getting hit with the splash and everything like that all the way through. It can actually be advantageous to be 22 back instead of being 17 back. That extra 5 lengths keeps your horse clean the entire trip, you know? And then when you're about to make your run, you make your run anyway. So, you know, I don't know. You can't employ that same style and win the Belmont. I agree with that. You know, I just don't. We don't see enough in his running lines, right? I mean, you'd have to go back and check every replay. But then even, okay, how does pace in Japan compare to who were the horses he was against? You know, I don't know that he's a 20-length come-from-behind horse. If all you do is look at the Kentucky Derby, you'd say this kind of horse doesn't fit. I mean, I'm like a little bit more inclined to look at Everfast coming from 20 back in the Preakness and say, okay, well, some of his better races, he was, you know, pretty far out of it, that maybe he's a deep closer. But Dale's no dummy, and, you know, he put his horse in the Preakness when everybody else said, what are you doing, and ran second with him. Dale knows you're not going to win the Belmont from being 20 back either. So Everfast isn't going to be 20 off the pace. So, you know, how these horses match up pace-wise in the Belmont will be different. Sir Winston, you know, is pretty determined, come-from-behind horse in his recent start. And, you know, Cassie's got two in there, so maybe he drops out the back. But I think a lot of these horses will try to be a bit more one-paced and march in the Belmont than try to lay back and make one run. You know, that's style. Sands Creator hasn't been very successful. And I have to go back and look at the chart. Creator's running lines were definitely drop way out of it and make a deep run. I can't remember how far back he was in the actual Belmont. Did he lay a little closer, or was Creator, you know, still his typical running style? You know, stereotypically, a horse like Creator doesn't win the Belmont with that kind of drop back 15, 20 and make a run. But I can't remember where he was in that race. I'd have to look at the chart. But those kind of horses don't win the Belmont often. You're right. So if Everfast and Master Fencer run the same kind of race in the Belmont that they did in the Preakness and the Derby, respectively, it's probably the wrong kind of style to win it.
Well, all I know is between Destin, it was Destin, right, that got nailed by Creator, and And I had the beat that I took was Commissioner. That was and there's, I mean, as often as Pletcher has won this race, there's two more that he could have won. Destiny.
Oh,
and,
no,
and,
he's
and
always
Commissioner.
There. You know, they're yeah. always right there. I think even the year that they splashed home in the slop with Ruler on Ice, the unimaginable winner. I think Pletcher was second or third in that one. You know, I mean, right there with them. With maybe Dunkirk, was that the year Dunkirk ran second after, you know,
yes,
Dunkirk
I think you're right. I think there's another one. That's right.
Derby,
that's right.
And then came back and, you know, I mean, he
that's
had a terrible
right.
Derby performance and didn't come out of the race healthy either. He was nicked up a little bit. And again, Todd had the 5 weeks, got him good. And I think that was the year that Dunkirk ran second. My memory goes away every once in a while where I'm not too sure on some of these years. They blend together sometimes. I'm calling up the chart on Creator. Creator stayed within 8 lengths. He was 8 lengths back after a half mile when he won the Belmont. He did rally from 10th, but again, 8 back. And for Creator, being 8 lengths off the pace with a mile still to run, that was a little closer than usual for him. And he needed all of it to win by a nose that year. Yeah, Destin was second. That was the year Lonnie was third. So Exaggerator never fired as a big favorite in that Belmont back in 2016. So... again, that's Creator, but from 8 back, not from, you know, 20. You're not gonna fall 20 lengths out the back end and win over a mile and a half. They just kind of march. The pace will be too slow to allow that to happen. But again, I don't know that these horses on paper will. You know, I think Everfast will stay closer than he did in the Preakness and Master Fencer. I'm guessing that he will, but again, there's your guesswork. You know, we have the one race, but we still have a lot of question marks with him. But again, it's at 10-1, the way he finished, and if you just flat believe that international horses are just a little more stamina trained and developed and long-winded in their works and the way that they prepare, then you could easily make a case for him to be a player in here And if you get the right price, maybe you pull the trigger on the win end.
Well, we'll be in New York starting Sunday and have coverage live from Belmont. In fact, I was talking to Pat McKenna yesterday from Naira about the arrangements and looking forward to it's hard when you discuss this, Jeremy. It's kind of hard not to be excited really about that Met Mile too on the card.
Yeah.
And it does look. I asked Pat about this actually. It looks like the Met, the broadcast. It does look like NBC is going to have the Met, the Manhattan, and Belmont as part of the 2 hour coverage. So
not having a Triple Crown on the line and not having, you know, like a Derby winner kind of horse in there probably opened up the production a little bit to say, look, we've got to fill 2 hours. We need good content. We're not as loaded on features as we would be in some other years and a lot of the other stuff that goes with it. So, the benefit for racing fans will be to see such a great race like that live.
Jeremy, I appreciate it, and that should get everybody kind of thinking about the field. We'll talk next week, and things will be firmed up. We'll see if some other names dive in, and I appreciate it.
All right, sounds good. Take care, everybody. Good luck, and check out that wager guide on Friday at ExpressBet.
Jeremy Plonk, horseplayernow.com. We're going to stay here, actually, because Linda Rice joining us, and Linda with a terrific day yesterday, the first of the three New York bred showcase days, the first one at Belmont, then another one in the fall, and of course we do it at Saratoga too, and a couple of the winners, and actually it's been a good several weeks of the early spring for Linda Rice, and newly minted in the Bowery, Blind Willie McTell in the Mike Lee, and we got to talk about Nicodemus as well, winning the Westchester. Linda, congratulations.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
I appreciate the visit, and let's talk about the filly first. And this is a nice story for a lot of reasons. Central Banker at McMahon is really turning into a success story. This was a Broman bred, and Beach Haven behind newly minted, $110,000 as a April OBS purchase last year, and now 3 for 3.
Yes, she Central Bank sure is having a good season, we had bought a Central Banker filly last year named Sassy Agnes for Beach Haven as well, I bought them two Central Banker fillies last year. One at the OBS March sale, Sassy Agnes, and then I bought newly minted at the OBS April sale. Sassy Agnes was very successful last year as a two-year-old, newly minted. Took some time to get her to the races, but it looks like it's going to pay off now, so we're excited.
This opportunity, obviously, to keep marching against the state breds, and the maiden win came in April. A couple of weeks later, he actually had a chance at a fast track finally yesterday. She'd been on a muddy track and a sealed slop track, so she's getting lots of experience. What's the game plan with her, Linda? I mean, it feels like there's lots of upside, and you got plenty of options even before facing open company.
Yeah, Steve, it was really nice to see her perform as well on a dry track as she had in a wet surface, so that was great. It was also great to see her come from behind horses, rate behind horses, take some dirt, and not lose interest. So we were very pleased all the way around, and it opened up some doors for us. Obviously, there's the obvious spot would be the Finger Lakes Oaks, and then on to the Fleet Indian at Saratoga. If we kept her in New York Breed Company. But I think that we are going to take a good look at the Victory Ride, which comes back on July 5th. It's grade 3, going 6.5 furlongs. And then, from there we'll see how she competes in open company. And, of course, graded company for, a filly is very important.
No doubt. But already well-established with this win. And, you know, she's out of a Bernardini mare. Just based on her action and her physique, how far do you think she wants to go?
You know, I'm pretty convinced that she's got no problem with a mile. You know, I don't know as far as two turns, mile 16th, mile 8th. I mean, time will tell. Physically, the way she's made, I think that she has a good chance to get two turns, but I don't think you know until you do it, you know. So.
And there's obviously, you know, there's also no rush. I mean, you could just take that on, you know, as she matures. You know, you've been spoon feeding her distance six and a half, now seven. So you can kind of bring her along that way. And there's no timetable, no rush.
Yeah, anyway. It's been a nice progression so far. I mean, obviously, you know, I got her to the races so late that I wheeled her back in a week into the Stallion Series. But we've at this point now we've got a nice progression, and you know, if we go to 6.5 in the next race, would be cutting her back a little bit. But it was sure nice to see her right behind horses, so we're not committed to, you know, one dimensional horse that has to have the lead. So, but I do think that, you know, she's certainly going to get a mile, and as she gets older and more seasoned, you know, I think there's a very good chance that two turns is within her wheelhouse, as you say.
Well, let's turn our attention to Blind Willie McTell. And a lot of people were excited about the Mike Lee, Linda, and you know, knowing how good this group is, you know, even restricted to New York breds, the 3-year-old sprint scene has been spirited, and he's been mixing it up and you know, facing, you know, pretty much a lot of the same ones. Bankett is back in New York now for Steve Asmussen and Winchell and Mr. Horton. And, you know, talk about this win, because it stamps him as, you know, as a sprinter that, you know, has got more upside yet.
Yes, you know, we thought that the Mike Lee was a pretty deep field. And, you know, I was watching Andy Serling and Anthony on the show, and you know, I mean, there were five or six horses that could win the race. You know, it's just all a matter of who has their best day and who shows up and who doesn't. Obviously, there was a late scratch behind the gates. That was a speed horse, so that really played in our favor. But Le General did press the pace. But all in all, I thought that he ran terrific. We were a little disappointed when he got beat in the Stallion Stakes. You know, we thought he could win that day, and just, you know, but he was coming off a bit of a layoff. Funny guy, the Terranova horse ran super, and so we were breath disappointed then, but he came back and certainly ran a bit nice race yesterday.
Well, and of course the horse you're referring to is with the oh my gosh, I talked about him yesterday with Nick.
Funny guy?
The scratch.
Yes. Stonebreaker.
Stonebreaker. Jesus. The horse of Roddy's, and I didn't think necessarily. I brought this up yesterday that he didn't have to be, you know, necessarily on the lead, and being set up outside, he was going to have the opportunity to, you know, to maybe survey the action and go, if, you know, if nobody else wanted to go, you know, Javier would have been able to make that assessment. I don't see how this race is any different, you know, considering the way Willie ran. He looked like it wouldn't have mattered if there was another horse pressing. He could have sat behind that scenario.
Yeah, he rated nicely off of Le General, and you know, when I saw the overnight come out on this on the Mike Lee, I thought, my gosh, any horse that has a chance is in this race. You know, they're not.
Yes.
Sitting on the sidelines. It was a very contentious field. So, you know, but it was a great result for our horse. Of course, he ran very well. We were really pleased.
Well, the 2-3-year-old races go your way. And you actually, you ran a good second in the filly and mare sprint too. And kind of ran into a little bit of buzzsaw. It did feel like Chad's filly, Catherine the Wise.
Yeah, Catherine the Wise. Yeah, she's a tremendous filly, and when she's on her game, she is just, You know, she puts up big numbers. She looked early in the year like maybe those numbers, that she was exceptional in the on the sloppy track, but it was a dry track yesterday, and she was really impressive. So but we were pleased to get Midnight Disguise back on track. I really believe she wants to run around one turn. She doesn't seem to take to the two turns. We've run her there a couple times. She did win early in her three-year-old year around two turns, but I don't think it's her best game. I think she's better off as a one-turn 7/8 or one-turn mile. And she performed well. You know, we were it was a good effort.
Well, the other race that I want to get in, Lynn, too, because we haven't talked about it, Nicodemus's win. And I was delighted for you. I was traveling, and the patience that was shown here, and, of course, for the Friedbergs and the Goichmans, what a nice reward.
Yeah, it was a real thrill. Avram and Rhoda were at the races that day, and it was their first graded win with a horse that, you know, they purchased last summer at the Horses of Racing Age sale in July from Windstar. So, and we got, you know, we ran him up at Saratoga, and then he had to, you know, be put on the bench again. So it was really rewarding to have given him the time and have him come back so well. And it was really exciting for them to get their first graded win. So it was a real thrill. Now, right now, I'm not sure where we're going next. We may just sit on him for a little while and point towards the grade three John Newred. I think that's on July 5th. So that seems to be the right spot for him.
Well, I'm just turning. I want to. There we go. There's Nicodemus, and the coming out of that Excelsior. The grade three, very nice, Westchester. And I, you know, typically a lot of horses are preparing for the Met Mile, but I think you're going to let that. Yeah, you can let that one go this year.
I think we should just sit back and watch.
That'll be you know, just nice to say. Well, we'll worry about that down the road, right?
It's
virtually every heavy head that you can think of is going to be lined up in there.
Yeah, exactly. So we think we'll just watch that event.
I don't blame you. I also, since Avi, we're talking Avi, the Karakoram Electra baby.
Yes, the City Zip Colt Electronic is his name.
Yes.
And, so he's a three-year-old. He's just made it to the races. And, of course, I trained City Zip, and I trained Karakoram Electra. She was quite a racehorse. I mean, she made about 500,000. I won 13 races with her, most of them at Belmont Park. So that's been a lot of fun to get him to the races. And he put in a very game effort yesterday. It looked like he was beat at the eighth pole, and then he just came back on and, you know, put him away.
What do you have in mind going forward?
You know, right now, probably, you know, he's young and he's kind of green. He got to the lead twice and he pricks his ears. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's pretty inexperienced, but I think he has quite a bit of talent. So I'm just going to let him go through his allowance conditions for now, shoot tour towards the two other than, and in hopes that, you know, next year, the four-year-old, that he could be an even better horse.
Well, things going beautifully, and we'll be upstate soon enough, Linda, and whether it's the state breds and then others, the things going nicely. We certainly, now that I'm you know, kind of come down for Belmont week, but you know, been home here for 10 days now after, you know, Triple Crown early part of the trail, and getting ready, you know, looking around Saratoga. Was around yesterday, actually, and Sunday we were at, you can feel the town getting in gear the slightly early start, but look forward to seeing you next week. Congratulations on nice run, Linda Rice, everybody. And yesterday, the three-year-olds, both they sweep, and then going back to Derby Day. the Westchester win for Nicodemus and our friends, the Friedbergs, and the Goichmans. Good partnership, too, the way they came together. I guess we'll stay here. We've only got a couple of minutes, really, to the top of the hour. And Andy will join us tomorrow. Andy, you know, just had the three-day week or the four-day week, so with the Monday broadcast yesterday. We'll get to Andy tomorrow, as well as Sid. Sid Fernando, a little sire watch. Speaking of which, that's one area I did not really get a hold yet of who were the big winners from the weekend. The Calbreds. you had Calbreds crush the stakes at Santa Anita. Look at this, right? Yeah, you had one, two, three, four, at least, I think four. Four Calbreds win stakes at Santa Anita. So an interesting weekend. And, of course, yesterday, with Vino Rosso, it's a nice win for Curlin. So we'll pick out a couple of spots and talk to Sid tomorrow. A couple of things that we didn't get to. You know, we talked was saving up the New York stuff, but in between the New York races, there was the, as part of the cross country that we talked yesterday with Nick Tamaro, and that Lone Star turf, Adore, went off, I think, second choice. And, yeah, second choice, a little under 4-1, paid $940. The big brown mare, Richard Aramia, aboard for Ron Winchell. And the heavy favorite, that Sensitive, took all the money, went off at 3-5. And just never, you know, we got close, but it was not really in doubt. And that horse we mentioned, the one inside, Terra's Angel. I said if you were going to play the try, use Terra's Angel. And in the fact, she ran a good race. She actually was a little closer at a certain point. Could have been second, but settled for third. Under Sasha Risenhoover, and he ended up with a $100 try. But Adore, $940, and that brought together the cross country when Pat on the Back won the anchor leg, came back to win the commentator, paid $670, second choice, Giant Expectations. Just could not get there. And the cross country paid $756. Nice payout. And, you know, it's interesting because they did not use the turf stake as part of the five, I assume, because they thought Offering Plan, you know, was going to be an overwhelming favorite. But Offering Plan got beat and beat on the square. Mo Maverick opened up that big lead and then got caught by Gucci Factor, the Clement with Jose Ortiz, and paid $11.20. So it if they had used that race in the cross country, it would have even boosted things even more. But $756, it was not an arduous sequence at all to get through. So that continues to be a fun bet. We've been trying it. The first leg, Naze for Jimmy Bond. If you had Nazi, you were in good shape, because then Catherine the Wise, you certainly were going to use. You were certainly going to use Blind Willie McTell, and Pat on the Back I guess you had to spread a little bit in the commentator. Anyway, 756, pretty good number. We got plenty of other. And I, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I'm a little hamstrung because yesterday, I thought I should. I've been having trouble with my directional signal on the computer, so I thought I should really, you know, get it checked and see if I can, you know, maybe, you know, the up down in particular. The up is okay. I basically couldn't navigate down, so I brought it in and got the annoying news that they needed to replace like the whole keyboard. So as a result, I'm without my laptop, and it's not easy. The communicating with Deja back at the studio, I'm on the phone doing this all on the phone, so it's a little bit awkward. It's going to be 2 or 3 days. Plus, I got to figure out a way to use the printer, all that stuff. I think I've got an air printer. I'm supposed to, but I couldn't get the air printer to. So I don't have my usual set of tools that are that make things go so swimmingly. Usually. So bear with us a couple of days. But thanks to Deja, pushing the buttons. We got some good news, by the way. Casey has had a good several days, and things seem to be better. A long way to go. But I think he getting out of the hospital will be a start. That'll help. But in the meantime, Joe and Deja doing just unbelievable, keeping us on the air. So thank you to them. And appreciate the, you know, the kind thoughts that people express to me about Casey. I'll hang in there. I want to thank Mark Glatt. That was a lot of fun. And Carly Gaines, Joe Bravo, Jeremy Plonk, and Linda Rice. Tuesday, you got some action around today. Parks in Indiana and more. Good luck if you're playing. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9, here on Sirius XM. And we'll pick up the ball at 9 and take you to noon again tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.